Hugh Nibley and Me by Don Norton. I was a semi-literate Idaho farm boy, something of a loner, when, in my mid-teens, I discovered Hugh Nibley's late 1940s articles in the Improvement Era. Nibley had answers to questions I had about the Restoration in general, and especially the Book of Mormon, a volume which I had only sampled and which was then very little talked about in the church. I became an avid reader of Nibley's articles in church periodicals. Later, my sophomore year at BYU, 1953-54, I enrolled in all three quarters of Nibley's classes on the history of early Christianity. His weekly broadcasts in 1954 over KSL radio were an additional treat. When in 1958 those broadcasts were being prepared for publication titled The World and the Prophets, I asked Hugh how his re-editing of the articles was coming along. He replied, "They're more true now than when I wrote them. Little further editing needed." And he had added a couple of chapters to the volume. But he always held reservations about editors who all too often felt compelled to spend time making edits he did not agree with. Well, editors are paid by the hour. I assured him that my edits of his writing would be minimal, since he knew as much about linguistic correction and good style as I did, now a budding professional editor. I believe I did tweak him on his insistence that the use of whose as a non-human pronoun referent was an error, in place of his observance of the traditional rule it called for of which. For example, the river whose, rather than of which its source was not far off. Yet I think I allowed some of his of whiches to remain. They reflect the era of his training as an informed and articulate writer. He commanded a variety of voices, from scholarly to informal, even casual, an unusual talent among scholars. When I finished editing and writing the foreword to his volume, Approaching Zion, which was one of his most popular, albeit controversial, volumes, I phoned Hugh and asked him what he wanted the title of the volume. He muttered a few possibilities, then concluded, "Well, it ought to be titled Zion, but we're not there as saints yet, so let's title it Approaching Zion." One story captures Hugh's sense of humor as well as his humility. When I joined the BYU faculty in 1967, I had just finished reading all of Brigham Young's discourses in the Journal of Discourses, and I learned that Hugh had just finished reading everything he could locate on what Brigham Young had written or said. On the phone, I told him, "Hugh, you once said you felt like a mental midget to the side of Brigham Young." Brigham Young used to boast he had boast of 8 days of formal education. "I said that?" Nibley asked. "Yes, you did. I heard you say it in a class you taught." "Well, I said it because it's true." "Can Shirley Ricks and I include it in the foreword?" "Yes, but only if you put it in boldface." It occurs in boldface on page Roman numeral X of the foreword to volume 13 of his collected works, Brother Brigham Challenges the Saints. He had also omitted one of Brigham Young's most plain and probing words of counsel on how to deal with the earth's sufficiency. "Just keep your dish right side up. Don't you try to fill it or you will lose your soul. Let the Lord fill it if he chooses." This is a paraphrase. Nibley's unusual modesty, even humility, a trait rare among scholars, surfaced often. "Who'd ever believe that all this stuff," one of his favorite words, "would ever be published?" he questioned at a picture party such as we used to celebrate when a new volume of collected works came out. I intercepted him one day on his way down to the Richards building for a swim. "What's new?" I asked him. "You know," he replied, "an undergraduate girl in one of my classes just brought to my attention something that's critical to the understanding of the Book of Mormon, something I'd overlooked," he added. I know of only one story in which he openly challenged, in a rare feat of pique, a group of closed-minded academic experts. "I read your journals. Do you read mine?" He had a habit of sampling recent articles in the leading journals of several disciplines other than his own. Nibley resisted trends toward the secularization of scholarly work, as well as the habit of many scholars to cultivate personal followings. His first remark on entering a classroom one day was, "Someone in the class has asked what is going to be on the final exam. Egads, the exam will attest what you know, not what I know." His final exams usually consisted of one, maybe two essay questions that drew on what the students themselves felt they had learned from their own notes on class lectures and suggested readings. I was assigned one semester to teach the writing portion, 2 credits, of a 5-credit course on ancient history taught in the honors program by 2 full professors of history. Mid-semester, a very bright female approached me on a Thursday. Quote, "I don't see any connection between what the history teachers are teaching us and the gospel," end of quote. I recommended that she purchase in the BYU bookstore Nibley's volume, The Ancient State, volume 10 of his collected works. The following Monday, I found the student stretched out limp on a chair on the front room of the classroom. Quote, "I bought the book, read it, and now I see that everything in the ancient world relates to the gospel." The student went on to earn a doctorate in Arabic and teach at a major American university. Nibley used to refer students to what he considered his most important scholarly insight, laid out in some 170 pages, also in the volume The Ancient State, on the contrast between mantic, that is, revelatory, that is, from beyond this world, versus sophic, the rational, the resources of the human mind. It's a must-read if one is to appreciate Nibley and his extensive writings. Over the years of Nibley's scholarly activity, there formed groups of BYU faculty and students, and even some Utah Valley residents, who attended his popular lectures and, as time permitted, sat in on some of his regular classes. Nibley seemed a bit wary of some students who came to his classes with a tape recorder, though he politely tolerated such recordings. I believe a few of his, quote, publications owe to edited transcriptions of those recordings. As is well known, Nibley took extensive notes on 3x5 cards, and he had a garage full of them. He typically lectured from a handful of them, and he also used them as he composed books and articles. I somehow once came into a possession of a stack of those cards, or perhaps a recording of the lecture in which he used those cards on a topic on which he had not yet published. Knowing well his writing style, I actually wrote them into an article, which later appeared in one of his books. I don't remember the subject of the article, and I don't think Hugh or his readers were ever aware that he had not himself published it, composed it. Why such interest in what he had to say? His insights into current and past history were simply illuminating, thanks to his perspective of the interplay of the universal forces of good and evil in which the drama of human behavior has played in the history of mankind. Nibley knew a lot, both mantic and sophic. As Truman Madsen said in the video, The Faith of an Observer, quote, "Nobody knows what Nibley knows," end of quote. Nibley's 19 collected volumes contain a refreshing reminder of what there is to know about humans and their behavior, good and bad, through their historical records, as well as the scriptures and the counsel of the living prophets themselves, about what should be our own individual most pressing concerns. At the end of many of his lectures, he often offered very simple counsel to his audiences and readers. Quote, "Get a testimony, find out from the Lord your calling in life, confess your weaknesses before the Lord, and don't forget to repent daily."